This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Close to 30,000 people a day are forced to flee their homes because of conflict and persecution. That's according to the UN Refugee Agency. And that means more people around the world are displaced now than ever before. And while war and international crises are often the subject of news reports, one Asheville-based author knew that kind of storytelling only goes so far. It may easily reach him and his friends, but not necessarily the middle schoolers in classrooms around the country. So he decided to tackle the topic through fiction to bring refugee stories to a new audience. Alan Gratz wrote a young adult book that tells the stories of three children seeking refuge at various points throughout history. The book is called Refugee. He's going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill talking about that book tonight. He'll be in Winston-Salem and Asheville later this month. But first, Alan Gratz joins me in the studio. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Hey, thanks, Frank. I appreciate it.
You've been writing young adult for young adult readers for more than a decade now. First of all, talk about young adult readers and why you want to reach them.
Yeah, I love this age. And I feel like if we can reach these kids in middle school and into high school, we can begin to develop empathy. We can begin to show them the world as we would like it to be. We can show them the world as it is, the world that is broken, and encourage them to try and fix it. I think that middle schoolers in particular have a profound sense of justice, like a real sense of right and wrong. They know what right and wrong is. And when you tell them, look, these people, they got driven from their homes by bombs, and now we won't let them in. They say, why? Why not? You know, they don't have those layers of complexity that adults have based on religion or politics or upbringing, what have you. They just see things in black and white. And I love that about them, and I have tried to write books that show them parts of the world that are broken or wrong. I've written books about the Holocaust and about terrorism in American society and about the Hitler Youth, and tried to show them when things have gotten really dark in human history, to say, like, let's not let this happen again. And as long as you see this now and you empathize with the victims of these movements, then perhaps that won't happen again.
So tell us how you chose to write this particular story about refugees, and again, how you decided to frame it for a young adult audience.
Sure, yeah. So it began with me with the MS St. Louis. So the MS St. Louis was a real ship that left Nazi Germany in 1939, right before World War II began, and it had about 950 Jewish refugees on board, and they were trying to escape Nazi Germany. Many of them had been in concentration camps, and this was before that became the final solution for many Jews. This was at a time when Nazi Germany was actually releasing people from those concentration camps with the ultimatum, like, get out. You have 2 weeks to get out of our country. So many of them bought tickets on the first ships available, and for many of them, one of those ships was the MS St. Louis. It was bound for Cuba, where many of them hoped to go and be refugees and to settle, but many more hoped to use it as a way station before they got into the United States, where at the time we had very strict quotas about the number of European Jews we would let in, and by early 1939, we'd hit our quota because people were fleeing Nazi Germany and fleeing what they saw was a coming war. So the ship gets to Cuba, and due to politics at the time, it is turned away. The refugees are not allowed to land. So it became a very famous story in the day. News planes were circling it. They had newsreels filming it. It was on the radio all the time and in newspapers, because the ship then cruised the eastern seaboard of the United States trying to get in. The United States would not let the refugees in. Canada would not let the refugees in. It ended up turning back to go to Europe, and those refugees were resettled into four different countries, one of which was the UK. Three of the others, though, were on the continent, and all of those refugees were right in Hitler's path when he invaded those countries just a few short months later. So I began with that story, and I was looking for a way into that story for young readers when my family and I went on vacation to Florida. And we were on Marathon in the Florida Keys, and we had spent the day by the pool reading books and swimming. And the next morning we went out, and there on the beach was a raft that somebody had taken to come to the United States. And one day it wasn't there, and the next day it was. And we were stunned by this. We walked around it. We talked about it. We discussed it as a family. It made us really question our privilege. It made us examine the things that we take for granted, the food on our table, the roof over our heads, the freedoms that we enjoy as American citizens. It made us realize that while we were vacationing and hanging out by the pool the day before, people had been risking their lives to come to this country. And I don't know who was on board that raft. I don't know if they made it here safely. I don't know where they came from. My best guess was that they came from Cuba, which is the closest of the Caribbean countries to the Florida Keys, 90 miles away across the Florida Straits. And but whoever they were, they had risked everything to come to this country. And I saw that. And here I'd been wanting to write about refugees in the 1930s, 70 years ago. And now I was like, wait a minute. Why am I not writing about this right now here?
And in fact, you ended up writing about three young people.
Right.
So tell us about them.
Yeah. So it turned out the Syrian refugee crisis was going on at the same time. And so I wanted to write about that, too, and wrap that in. And so it became the story of three different children from three different eras. Joseph, a Jewish boy who longs to grow up and be a man, who is going to get his wish in ways that he didn't want when his father is unable to handle having been in a concentration camp and then being turned away from refuge. And it's the story of Isabel, who is a Cuban girl who loves music but worries that when and if she gets to Miami, she will lose that part of her that is uniquely Cuban, that she will not hear that clave, that hidden beat under Cuban music that she would have if she had stayed in Havana. And it's also the story of Mahmoud. And Mahmoud is a Syrian boy who is escaping Aleppo with his family, his younger brother Walid and his baby sister Hannah and his mother and father trying to get to Germany in the present day. And I was able to weave all three of those stories together into Refugee, not only to show the parallels over the decades and across borders, but also I also found a way to bring those stories together and connect those actual families over time.
Yeah, I mean, one of the parallels, and it should not be forgotten, I think sometimes is poorly understood, is that while we are rejecting refugees today, and we can see that kind of behavior in which we are turning people back who are in harm's way, we did that during World War II or before World War II. We tell ourselves a story about a greatest generation that liberated Europe, but in fact, we turned our backs on the Jews in their hour of need.
That's right. And I wanted to show that. I wanted to show that we as a country have made that mistake in the past and that we are in danger of making that again. And but I also wanted to not make this just about the United States and to show refugees trying to get to Germany in the present day as well. So it's a problem that many countries suffer from, not in my backyard. You know, I mean, it's the we're all for people to get help and for refugee, you know, to give money to refugee organizations as long as they don't settle the refugees in our neighborhood.
Maybe I can get you to read for us. You want to
I'd love to read
a section of Mahmoud's story.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a part of the story where Mahmoud and his family have made it to Turkey from Syria and have now crossed the Aegean Sea and landed at the island of Lesbos, a common entry point into the European Union for refugees from the Middle East. And they're taking a ferry from Lesbos to Athens. And at the time, in 2015, those ferries were also shared by tourists. And so he finds himself on board a ferry with tourists, and he joins in with some other Muslims in morning prayers, but notices that the tourists eye them a little warily because of this. So we'll pick that up. We'll pick the story up there. The vacationers dropped their voices, and even though Mahmoud couldn't understand what they were saying, he could hear the disgust in their words. This wasn't what the tourists had paid for. They were supposed to be on holiday, seeing ancient ruins and beautiful Greek beaches, not stepping over filthy, praying refugees. They only see us when we do something they don't want us to do, Mahmoud realized. The thought hit him like a lightning bolt. When they stayed where they were supposed to be, in the ruins of Aleppo or behind the fences of a refugee camp, people could forget about them. But when refugees did something they didn't want them to do, when they tried to cross the border into their country, or slept on the front stoops of their shops, or jumped in front of their cars, or prayed on the decks of their ferries, that's when people couldn't ignore them any longer. Mahmoud's first instinct was to disappear below decks, to be invisible. Being invisible in Syria had kept him alive, but now Mahmoud began to wonder if being invisible in Europe might be the death of him and his family. If no one saw them, no one could help them. And maybe the world needed to see what was really happening here.
Alan Gratz, reading from his young adult novel, Refugee. He's going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tonight and Winston-Salem in Asheville later in the month. We've got the information at our website, stateofthings.org. You base this story, at least Mahmoud's story, of Mahmoud's brother based on a photo, a very well-known photo that was taken during the Syrian crisis in Aleppo.
Yeah, all my kids are fictional, but I tried to use real children that I had read about and sort of use amalgamations of those real people and you know, combine those different real characters that I'd real people that I'd read about into my characters. In particular, though, Mahmoud's younger brother, Walid, as you point out, was based on a very famous photograph that maybe some of the listeners will be familiar with. It's of a boy sitting in the back of an ambulance, and he is covered from head to foot in like concrete dust, and he's a little bloody and clearly shell-shocked, but there's an emptiness in his eyes. There's a hollow look, and that struck me, and I wanted to write about that character. I wanted to write about what the UN calls a lost generation of children in Syria. These are many children. Look, the Syrian civil war began in 2011. It's been going on for almost 7 years now. Some of these children were born into that conflict or born right before it, and they have known nothing but war. They have not been to school. They have not been reading books. They have barely been having conversations with other children and adults. They are a lost generation who have lost that incredibly formative time in their lives. And I wanted to talk about – Mahmoud is old enough to where he remembers Syria before the war, but his younger brother is not. And he's trying to draw him back and make him human again.
You talked about the ability of young adult readers to absorb this mm-hmm. kind of information. They have the intelligence and the capacity to take it in. But as a writer, how do you decide, you know, what level of detail to use when you're talking about some horrific stories?
Sure. The only concession I really make in writing for kids that I would do differently in writing for adults is I hold back on the gory detail, for lack of a better term for it. I will tell you, you know, like in Refugee, when they do arrive at the island of Lesbos, they see a child who is washed up from drowning, a child who was on board a raft that was overturned and the body has washed up on the beach. I tell the kids, the readers, about that. I mean, there is a dead body here. And the family rushes to the body, worried that it's somebody that they know. It's not. But in seeing that body on the page, I don't have to describe it in detail what it looks like. It's enough that I just tell you that a child has washed up dead on the beach. And that allows young readers to fill in the blanks as much as they are capable of and as much as they're willing to.
Right.
You know, I think kids are terrific self-censors. If they see something that is beyond them or too much for them, they turn off. They skip it. They'll just move on. It's why many kids can read adult books and not see the things that we come mm-hmm. back as adults and see later. You're like, wow, I just totally missed right. that, you know? And so I want to be as honest as possible. And I think that verisimilitude is what my young readers really respond to most.
You have used sensitivity readers for your work, and I'm mm-hmm. curious about that and was interested to see that you did because, of course, you're talking about people from other cultures
right.
and other time periods. Have they found that? What sort of things did you stumble over as someone
right.
who wasn't competent particularly in a particular culture?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I can do as much research as possible, and I will still never know everything about another culture, yeah. right? And so I love having other readers from the cultures I'm writing about read my book before it comes out, give me notes, and I incorporate as many of those as possible. For example, when I was writing the Cuban story, I had referred to, you know, all along the way, they talked about getting to America. And I had a Cuban reader say, oh, no, Cubans don't call America America. You know, they would call it the States, maybe, but mostly they would call it El Norte, like the North. And that often refers to specifically to Miami, but also largely to the country as a whole, because for many Cubans, Miami is America. And that's something that no book that I had read, no interview I'd listened to ever told me. And that's something I needed a Cuban reader to say, no, we call it El Norte. And so it's little things like that helped me make this feel authentic and genuine.
You've been visiting schools, and I wonder what your young readers think of this.
So far, the book's been out for about a month, and I've visited a few schools about it. They've been really engaged in it. It's being read. I just visited a classroom up in Chapel Hill and this morning, and they're doing a fifth grade read aloud all across the different classrooms, reading it and talking about it. And they are invested in these kids' stories. They are interested in the refugee crisis worldwide, and it's getting them talking about it, and it's getting them motivated to do something about it.
You know, it's interesting because you talked about the profound sense of justice, mm-hmm. and that's, of course, developmentally what we see. You know, that he took that, and that's
exactly.
not fair, and all of that.
Right.
So this would appeal to them, but also they're hearing from parents about fairness and what's right. And yep. I was born in this country, and we worked hard, or whatever the story they were telling.
Right.
So it's not right that other people come. Are you hearing that, or is that some of what they're telling, reflecting to you?
I get a little bit of pushback, you know, and I hear them. I hear some of those kids who are pushing back saying things I know have come from their parents or that they've heard on television. And I just feel like it's my job to say, like, I hear you, I understand what you're saying, but let me tell you what I learned in my research. Let me tell you what I learned is the truth of the situation. And, you know, somebody could pick up refugee and say, great, I'm glad we're keeping those folks out of our country. That's obviously not what I hope they will take from it. But what I tried to be apolitical with the book. I tried to just show the situation as it was in the past and as it is now. You know, the word refugee has become a hot button political word because for so many people, the word refugee means Syrian Muslim. And for so many Americans, Syrian Muslim equals terrorists. You know, that's wrong, but that's the way many people feel. And so then therefore they equate the word refugee with terrorists, even though there have been zero documented cases of anyone admitted to the country as a refugee committing an act of terrorism. But it's become a really political word. And my hope with this book is that the young readers will see that there is no one face to refugees. There's no one race. There's no one religion. There's no one point of origin to refugees.
Alan Gratz, an Asheville-based young adult author who has his newest book is called Refugee. Alan, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Alan's going to be reading at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tonight, Bookmarks Festival in Winston-Salem tomorrow. He's going to be at Malaprop's bookstore in Asheville later in the month, and we've got all the details at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley's our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.